1968-78, United States versus McRae.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Robert Littlehill from the Paul Weiss Law Firm, here representing Madison McRae in this matter. When read together, the Supreme Court's decisions in Harbison and Gonzalez simply leave no room for the government's argument in this case. In Harbison, the Supreme Court interpreted the COA statute to govern only final orders that dispose of the merits of a habeas corpus proceeding. In Gonzalez versus Crosby, the court made clear that true 60B motions can do no such thing.
Can we talk about Harbison first for a minute?
Yes, Your Honor.
I find that a very difficult decision to figure out exactly what it does provide precedent for. I mean, you can read it the way you've just said, or you can read it as sort of one-off, that this is such an unusual situation that the Supreme Court made it sort of like they've said about Bush versus Gore. I mean, you know, having no precedential effect, just deals with that one situation. And can you, maybe you can give me your best case on why we wouldn't look at it that way.
Well, I have several answers for that, Your Honor. I think first and foremost, all the parties agreed in that case that a COA was unnecessary.
That's all the more reason why the Supreme Court didn't decide it. Well, because all the, you know, we have countless cases where the Supreme Court tells us, well, that issue wasn't before us in that earlier case.
So well, respectfully, Your Honor, they did exactly the opposite, and they actually made a ruling on their interpretation of the plain language of the COA statute. They could have very easily said, all the parties agree, this isn't the best vehicle to decide this, and we'll dismiss the first issue on which we granted certiorari as improvidently granted. Now, the court didn't do that. They actually went in and said, Justice Stevens read the plain language of the statute and said, it's a merits or a non-merits test, and this type of motion simply does not touch upon the merits of the constitutional issue.
Isn't the language that you're talking about, doesn't it say a final judgment on the merits? Something like that. I mean, and it's a complete phrase, so it's unclear to me, anyway, where the emphasis was.
Yes, Your Honor. The language the court used was that the COA statute governs only, quote, final orders that dispose of the merits of a habeas
so
corpus
final
proceeding.
Orders.
Final order that disposes of the merits. And the important takeaway to me, Your Honor, is that in the Gonzalez against Crosby case, the Supreme Court explained that true 60B motions cannot talk about the merits. They have to attack the integrity of the first federal habeas proceeding. Now,
That sort of makes sense, I guess, when you think about it in terms of what the process is for setting up why successive motions would not be permitted for the most part without a COA.
Yes.
If you're attacking the procedure of it and what was going on, that's not something you had an opportunity to do before because it hadn't happened.
Yes, Your Honor. And in addition to that, the real problem with applying the COA test to the 60B context is that under Gonzalez, 60B motions cannot raise constitutional issues. If you raise a constitutional issue in your 60B motion, that's an improper successive 2255 petition. And in fact, as the Supreme Court argued in its amicus briefs in the Harbison case, in the context of a habeas proceeding for the purposes of a COA statute, it's concerned with whether or not the petitioner challenges the lawfulness of his detention based upon alleged violations of the Constitution, the laws, and the treaties of the United States. And where a petitioner, as in this case, advances a claim that doesn't touch upon constitutional issues, the COA test, which looks to whether he could show a substantial showing of a denial of a constitutional right, simply makes no sense. In the words of the United States, in their amicus brief, applying the test to those sorts of contexts is incongruous, difficult to apply, and incompatible, and we certainly agree. Now, in such circumstances,
but the problem is, the backstory is that the Supreme Court, and I suppose Congress as interpreted by the Supreme Court, has been so stingy about habeas petitions, successive habeas petitions, that it seems unlikely that, I mean, your rule makes perfect sense. I agree with you all. But we're trying to figure out where this is lies in the whole specter of cases.
And I think here's the interesting thing. In the Harbison decision, we just don't have one opinion by Justice Stevens for the court. we have Justice Stevens' opinion and a number of concurring opinions and a dissenting opinion. And in none of those other opinions, and Chief Justice Roberts wrote an opinion, I believe Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia wrote opinions, and none of those opinions did they mention, well, yes, we're announcing this very clear-cut rule, merits, non-merits, and the important thing is the United States, in its amicus brief in the Harbison case, actually pointed out in a footnote, look, this doesn't apply to 60B motions. They're different. But in their analysis, they don't really explain why they're different. And the court didn't say, as it did in Gonzalez, hey, we're not deciding this issue today. This is something that might come up down the road.
No, but it didn't say it was deciding it.
Yes.
It didn't, you know.
But
it doesn't reach the footnote.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think what
it
does.
I mean, that would be more helpful to you.
Well, it would certainly be more.
The Solicitor General suggests this doesn't apply to, which they do sometimes.
Yes, but I think ultimately, having been fully briefed and argued on that issue.
Well, I'm not sure about fully briefed and argued. It's certainly not fully briefed and argued in this context.
Well, I would argue that it was briefed in the amicus brief from the United States.
Because of that one footnote.
Because of the footnote. And it was in their footnote in their, they actually argued against, I believe they argued against certiorari on that first point, and they dropped a footnote there, and they discussed it again in their amicus brief on the merits before the Supreme Court. But I think fundamentally the government's surreply brief in this case doesn't grapple with the interaction between Gonzalez and Harbison. Instead, the government contends that because the order in Harbison, a motion for the appointment of counsel, is different from a 60B motion, that Harbison simply has no import to this case. But the problem is, ultimately, Harbison has been cited by a number of other courts in a number of other non-merits contexts. The 3rd, 5th, 9th, and 11th circuits have all said Harbison just doesn't apply to a motion for the appointment of counsel. It applies to such things as Rule 11 sanctions motion, modification of a protective order, and so on. In fact, the government's own surreply cites a case called Hickman against Cameron that involves a filing injunction. Now, that's clearly not a motion for the appointment of counsel. That's something completely different. It's clear from these cases, in our view, that the Harbison court's interpretation of the COA statute was not dependent upon the particular motion in that case. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, there's no limiting language in that case that suggests that is indeed the case. Rather, the court's ruling provided general guidance for, we believe, the first time of what the COA provision applies to. And the Supreme Court said it governs final orders that dispose of the merits of a habeas corpus proceeding. I think the second main argument the government has is that even after Gonzalez and Harbison, various courts continue to require 60B movements to obtain a COA. But these cases share many common attributes. To begin with, many are pro se petitioners. They aren't counseled. The government in many of these cases does not file briefs of their own. And I think importantly, in none of these cases, in any single Court of Appeals case that we have found, has the Harbison issue been briefed and argued to a Court of Appeals. And I think that's important. I think this court, for that reason, should address these important issues in this case. And I think if we take a closer look at the Hickman against Cameron decision that the government cites in their surreply, I think you notice a few things about that case. First, it's an unpublished per curiam Third Circuit case. It was also issued without briefing from the government, and nowhere in the pro se prisoner's handwritten petition is there a Harbison-based argument. And in the court's discussion of the COA requirement, it's based entirely on pre-Harbison, pre-Gonzalez case called Morris against Horn. So our argument is that business as usual, courts continue to do this, is not a proper argument when there's been intervening decisions in the law, especially when the Ninth Circuit has observed that true 60B movements do not need a COA to appeal. Lastly, Your Honors, even if a COA were required, as we explained in our opening brief, I think the first thing the court needs to do is ascertain what type of motion sits before it can apply one test or the other. And the government in this case concedes that the district court erred in construing and dismissing Ms. McRae's claims. Under Reed and Weinstock, we argue that the proper remedy, as the court said, is remand in these instances. In simple terms, this court should not wade into such fact-intensive inquiries, such as the proper denial or dismissal of a 60B motion, and allow the district court to do that in the first instance in this case. Unless there are further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller.
(Clears Morning. My name is William Miller here on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. Under the plain language of the statute, McRae must satisfy the requirements for obtaining a certificate of appealability in order to appeal the district court's dismissal of his motion. And because he's unable to satisfy those requirements, his appeal must be dismissed. To begin with your question about Harbison, Judge Motz, McRae does read that case too broadly. It's important first to look at what was actually at issue in Harbison. The motion that was denied and appealed in Harbison was for federally appointed counsel in state clemency proceedings that postdated the habeas proceeding. And so in that sense, there's really no question that that's disconnected from the merits or the judgment in the habeas case. By contrast, a Rule 60B motion, by definition, is challenging the validity of the judgment in the habeas case. And so in that regard, there's a much closer connection to...
But it's not challenging the underlying proceedings.
It's not raising constitutional issues, but it's attacking the validity of that judgment in the proceedings. And so by definition...
It's attacking the validity of the habeas proceedings.
Correct. And the judgment is the final judgment in the habeas case that's under attack.
Specifically, it's attacking the way in which the judge handled the first one, I take it, which means there's been no previous opportunity to do that because that happened in the first one. So what's excessive about it?
The 60B is attacking, I'm not sure I'm following Your Honor's question.
What he seeks in this 60B, as I understand it, B6, is that not right?
Actually, B6 would not apply in this case because, as this court held in Aiken, when you have a B1 through 5, you don't get to B6. And here, the allegations in the 60B motion...
The question is the same. What's successive about a Rule 60B 1 through 5 motion when you're not dealing with the same issues that you dealt with in the underlying habeas petition? You're dealing with some mistake that the habeas judge made.
The government concedes that the district court got it wrong on that point about whether or not this was a successive petition.
Okay.
There's at least one claim that was a successive claim, so it's in fact a mixed petition.
Right.
But the district court mischaracterized those claims. But that's not the end of the inquiry under the certificate of appealability analysis. And so we're kind of jumping around, but once you get to the certificate of appealability analysis, the petitioner has to show both that there was a procedural error or a debatable issue on the procedural ruling, but also that reasonable jurists would disagree about whether or not the claim states a plausible claim of the denial of a constitutional right. And that's where McRae's petition fails when you undertake the certificate of appealability analysis.
What's the applicability of Gonzalez?
Gonzalez doesn't say anything about whether or not a certificate of appealability should issue. What Gonzalez talks about is whether or not a 60B petition has to meet the additional requirements for a successive petition. This court's case in Weinstock already held that it didn't. And so Gonzalez is really talking about the characterization of the motion. It doesn't say anything about whether or not a certificate of appealability is required. The certificate of appealability requirement is just a screening mechanism so that this court can avoid devoting its resources and undertaking appellate review of cases that facially do not even present a debatable claim of the denial of a constitutional right. And so the issue of the characterization of the motion doesn't say anything about whether or not that requirement applies. And so in Gonzalez, the Supreme Court actually noted that most circuits have required a certificate of appealability to appeal the denial of a 60B motion, and it cited this court's case in Reed in support of that proposition. And so Gonzalez cannot be read to either explicitly or implicitly overrule the court's cases that have held that a certificate of appealability is required to appeal the denial of a 60B motion. And moving back to
just a few minutes ago, you sort of stated very concisely your view of what should happen. And I just want to be sure I understand this. Is it your view that even if and when I say you, I mean the government, and in fact, this maybe ask you this preliminary question. Have you all consulted with the Solicitor General's office or Maine Justice on this case?
Not to my knowledge.
Because it seems to me it would appear in other circuit courts, and we don't have, or perhaps don't have, a definitive answer from the Supreme Court. It would probably be worthwhile knowing what the government's view is going to be when it gets to the Supreme Court.
Well, the government's view is also well set out in its amicus brief in the Harbison case, where it stated that the Certificate of Appealability requirement would apply to Rule 60B motions, and that although a Certificate of Appealability was not required to appeal the denial of the issue in Harbison, it still would be required to appeal the denial of a 60B motion.
And the reason why you distinguish this case from Harbison is? I know they're different, they raise different claims.
Harbison is distinguishable because the motion at issue there was disconnected from the merits of the habeas
proceeding. So it's how far you're disconnected from the merits, not the underlying merits, because that would seem to be what Harbison is about, but about the merits of the habeas case, according to you.
Correct. The government's position is that a Rule 60B motion, by definition, is attacking that final judgment in the habeas case.
A Rule 60 motion in a habeas proceeding, not a Rule 60 motion.
Correct, in the habeas. The Rule 60B in a habeas proceeding.
And help me, Harbison involved a habeas proceeding?
Harbison involved, the motion for federally appointed counsel was in the federal case, but the petitioner was seeking federally appointed counsel for his subsequent state clemency proceeding. So
the whole habeas thing wasn't really an issue.
That's the government's point, is that it was divorced from the merits of the habeas case.
Okay.
It was seeking counsel for a subsequent proceeding.
Thank you for that clarification. Now, am I to understand that the government's position is that even if we should agree with the appellant here, that there no COA is necessary, we could just assume for purposes of argument no COA is necessary, look at this and say it's meritless?
That's not exactly the government's position, because the government's position is that under these circumstances, a certificate of appealability requirement is jurisdictional. And so
you think we have to reach that question?
The only way the court would not reach that question is if it concludes that under these circumstances, a certificate of appealability is not required, in which case we'd be proceeding under 1291, and the government's position is there this court could nevertheless affirm the district court's.
But I mean, that I guess I said it incorrectly, but isn't that the appellant's position that no COA is necessary?
That's correct, but I just wanted
maybe I said it wrong, but the government's position is, I see. So you want to make clear is that this is a fallback position on the
correct.
Part of the government.
It's a fallback position. Under the government's view of the case, the certificate of appealability is jurisdictional. And so before undertaking
they need to do it.
Correct.
But if we should conclude that that's not the case, and no COA is necessary, then the government's fallback position is that we should
nevertheless affirm the district court's denial of the motion. But that like the court has characterized it, is the fallback position. I mean, the government's firm belief is that a certificate of appealability is required to appeal the final order in a proceeding in a 2255 case. That's the statute. That's the plain language of the statute. And this court held in Reed versus Angelone that plain language requires a certificate of appealability in a 60B case, even when the issue is whether or not the district court properly classified that motion. And so before reaching that issue, the court has to undertake the certificate of appealability screening analysis. And McRae's position too quickly dismisses of this court's precedent in Reed based on Supreme Court cases that he says by implication overturned this court's binding precedent.
Well, can't Reed be read to hold that only appeals from the denial on the merits of a 60B motion require a COA? And that we don't have that here?
In Reed, there was no ruling on the, it cannot, because the court's analysis in Reed was of a procedural ruling in the 60B. The defendant in Reed filed a 60B, taking issue with the district court's dismissal of. Let me start that over. In Reed, the 60B motion that was at issue was an attempt by the defendant to withdraw his habeas petition. And so that was a procedural ruling. The district court said, no, you may not withdraw your habeas petition. My dismissal with prejudice stands. And so it is a procedural ruling, like there was a procedural ruling in this case. And so the Court of Appeals did not engage in an analysis of the merits initially when it decided that a certificate of appealability was required.
Here the district court dismissed the petition.
That's correct. The district court dismissed the petition.
It strikes me as a little different than Reed in that respect.
That is a distinction, but I don't think it's a distinction without a difference in this case, because this court's precedent requires a certificate of appealability to appeal the denial of a Rule 60B motion. It also requires a certificate of appealability to appeal the denial of a successive petition. And so under the plain language of 2253C, both of those scenarios are susceptible to the certificate of appealability screening requirement. And so it's a distinction, but I don't think it's a distinction that matters in this case. And I also want to point out another distinction in Reed. In McRae's reply brief, he argues that Reed requires, even if the court agrees that a certificate of appealability is required, that Reed would hold that this court should remand to the district court to consider the timeliness and whether or not the mistakes rise to the level of a constitutional issue in the first instance. But that's not what Reed did. Reed, when it undertook the certificate of appealability analysis, found that the underlying motion in fact included a claim that was a debatable issue of the denial of a substantial right. And so Reed went through the proper analysis that the government urges the court to undertake in this case and applied the SLAC criteria, which requires first a debatable issue of the denial of a substantial constitutional right, and second, a debatable issue on the procedural ruling. It just came out a different way from the way this court would come out should it undertake that certificate of appealability analysis in this case. In this case, examining the underlying motion for a substantial issue of the denial of a constitutional right leads to a different outcome. Here, the mistakes that McRae highlights in his 60B motion all went to this issue of ineffective assistance of counsel on the Miranda issue and the failure to file the motion to suppress. Those mistakes that are raised in the 60B motion do not present a substantial question of the denial of a constitutional right, which is the first requirement under certificate of appealability analysis, because first, the district court's ruling on that ineffective assistance of counsel claim rested on prejudice and the fact that the evidence was overwhelming. And so any mistake and failure to file the motion, the court says, would not have changed the outcome on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim because the government's evidence was overwhelming. Secondarily, those mistakes that McRae highlights in his 60B motion are either not mistakes or they didn't affect the outcome either. And so when the court goes through the certificate of appealability analysis, McRae fails to show the substantial denial of a constitutional right, and therefore the appeal in this case should be dismissed. In essence, the government's position is that a certificate of appealability is required to appeal the denial of a Rule 60B, whether or not that's a dismissal or a denial on the merits, and that's what this court and every other court of appeals that has considered the issue has held, that the denial of a 60B requires a certificate of appealability.
But counsel, you concede that this needs to go back. You think the court made some error?
The court made some error, but the government does not concede that it needs to go back. The government's position is that when this court undertakes a proper certificate of appealability analysis, the only conclusion it can draw is that there is no debatable issue of the denial of a constitutional right. And so when you undertake that certificate of appealability analysis,
what part do you concede was done incorrectly?
At the first level, the district court improperly characterize all of these claims as successive claims.
All right.
And so that goes to the second prong under SLAC, which is whether or not there's a debatable issue on a procedural ruling. It doesn't relieve the court of undertaking the analysis under the first prong, which requires an examination for a debatable issue of the denial of a constitutional right. And that's where McRae fails. And his failure under that prong means no certificate of appealability should issue, and the appeal should be dismissed. And this is all consistent with the purposes of AEDPA and Congress's intent in enacting 2253, which is to screen out non-meritorious habeas motions. And so,
I thought you said that aspect was meritorious.
There's two parts. There's the procedural ruling, and then there's whether or not there was a substantial denial of a constitutional right.
Correct.
The district court's procedural ruling, the government concedes, was incorrect.
All right.
It's a two-part test, though, and both prongs have to be satisfied.
But see, that's one of the problems. If you're dealing with a 60B motion, you're basically giving them a task that's impossible. Because, as you call it, COA is a screening process, but the screen is designed that it will never get through it. Because even when you can see something went wrong, it doesn't make the screen. That's why I want you to go through what you said. You can see was procedurally wrong, but you say, but there's another prong. It won't reach the constitutional aspect in that sense. So isn't that fundamentally, used to be a term, unfair, meant something, but now more and more it seems like I'm looking at these cases, it doesn't mean much, but isn't that fundamentally erroneous? That you design a screen that's impossible for the 60B motion to even make it, for us to even see it, because the cost of our looking at it is too high for them to bear.
The second prong plays an important role.
Maybe one way to look at this is for you to posit an example where you would have your problem, your error, and you would say that the other prong had not been met.
The example is Reed, where both prongs were satisfied. In that case, when the court undertook the certificate of appealability analysis, it looked to the merits of the underlying motion and found that one of those ineffective assistance of counsel claims did present a debatable issue of the denial of a constitutional right. And it also held that the district court's procedural ruling was incorrect. That was an important part of the court's analysis, and that's why it issued the certificate of appealability. Ultimately, in Reed, what the court decided is that the district court improperly characterized the petition and that, in fact, was a mixed petition with multiple claims, and therefore it remanded. But before
don't we have a mixed petition as well?
Yes, ma'am, we do. But before we even get to the characterization of the petition, under the certificate of appealability analysis, this court has to satisfy itself that one of the claims in Mr. McRae's underlying habeas petition presents a debatable issue of constitutional law.
And that may be right, but it seems very odd that we would, in order to see if this has been properly dismissed, like no decision on the merits, we would have to go look and see if the merits argument is meritorious.
It's not odd under the certificate of appealability requirement, because to interpret it otherwise would require a remand regardless of whether or not the defendant has shown that there's potential merit to the underlying motion. And that's exactly what the screening requirement is designed to prevent. It's to prevent a remand in cases where, despite a procedural ruling, there's no hope for the petitioner on the merits of the underlying motion. And so it comports with the purpose of the statute, which is to promote finality and to conserve resources. If this court decides that Mr. McRae's underlying motion does not present a debatable claim of the denial of a constitutional right, then that ends the issue because no certificate of appealability should issue in that case. But and that's an important screening mechanism, because otherwise a remand is a waste of time.
Well, let's look at it this way. You would agree the procedural aspect, that first prong that you concede was done incorrectly, the district court had the authority to correct that and rule in his favor, correct? It did not, but it could have.
It could have gotten it correct.
Could have gotten it correct and granted relief, correct?
Not based on the claims that.
Well, why would the part that you? I'm not trying to trick you. The part that you concede was done incorrectly, that could have been done the other way, and would have been correct, and relief would have been granted, correct?
On the merits of the underlying motion.
The procedural aspect that was incorrect, the court could have gotten it correct.
The government's position is that there's no debatable issue here on the denial of a substantial constitutional right.
I think it would help me, in answer to Judge Gregory's question, if you stated what it is you think that the district court got wrong,
The district court...
You know, in words, not just one issue.
Right. The district court erroneously characterized this entire motion as a successive petition, when in fact it included multiple claims that were true 60B claims. And that was an error on the procedure. That's only one part of the certificate of appealability analysis, however. When it comes up on appeal, this court has to not only decide whether or not there's a debatable issue on the procedural ruling, which is that characterization of the petition, it also has to look to the merits of the underlying motion and determine whether or not there's a chance that McRae could ever win on the merits. Essentially, whether or not, to use the language of Slack, there's a debatable issue of the denial of a constitutional right.
Okay, so spin out what the district court's error resulted in that was erroneous.
The district court's error resulted in a dismissal on the wrong grounds, essentially. But that's not enough for it just
no,
to commit
a procedural
error. No, I understand
that, and I'll let you go say that again. But we're trying to, going to Judge Gregory's question, well, shouldn't we send it back so they can get it right? If you can spell out for us what the court did wrong in terms of actual terms of a couple of the claims, in other words.
What the court should have done, and this is what Weinstock says it should have done, is allow the petitioner to elect to withdraw its one successive claim and proceed with its 60B motion with that one, because it's a mixed petition. So right. What it should have done under Weinstock is allow the withdrawal of that one successive claim and proceed on the 60B claims.
And all the others are 60B claims?
Yes.
And what's the one?
The one claim that was not 60B was essentially trying to relitigate the Miranda issue by highlighting other statements that were made. Okay. And so that was a constitutional attack that represented a successive 2255 claim in this case. And so the procedural error was that what the district court should have done is allow withdrawal of that claim and to proceed on these mistakes and inconsistencies that it highlighted, which are true 60B claims. The government's position is that once that gets appealed, the court has to not only look at the procedural ruling, but also look and determine whether or not there is a debatable issue on the denial of a constitutional right.
Right, and
that's where McRae is unable to
right,
make
it. And that's what I'm saying. Even if it wasn't a mixed question, if it was solely 60B questions, and the district court got it incorrect and said, no, this is successive. When it comes here, we have to view it under the metric of both prongs, right? Even though it's all 60B pure motions, we have to look at both prongs in a COA, correct?
Yes. Right. If there were a ruling on the merits, this court would still have to...
No, forget about the merits. Based on what the 60B motions, we'd have to look at both prongs to determine if it meets the standard for COA, correct?
Yes.
But it never could meet that. That's my point.
That's my point as well, Your Honor.
Yeah, but then that would give then the district court the final word on being wrong about giving a litigant a chance to be heard on 60B motions, because you say, you could be cavalier. Yeah, I was wrong about that. It shouldn't have been successive. But as to you, it won't make your cut because it'll never meet the second prong of constitutionality. Isn't that correct? Isn't that the practical result of your argument?
I guess it is, but it's really just a screening requirement, Your Honor. I mean,
I
it's almost akin to
12b-6. Yeah,
did he state a claim
screening
upon which relief could be granted? And here, did he state a debatable issue of constitutional law? And if the answer to that is no, then no certificate of appealability issues, and the appeal has to be dismissed. And so what this court and Congress is trying to accomplish, and I see that my time is expired, but
we're keeping you.
What Congress is trying to accomplish is to screen out those cases where there's no chance of the defendant or the petitioner prevailing on the merits. And so that's why
there's a constitution to make sure Congress can't screen out justice. That's why we're here. Certainly, they may try to screen.
There would be no
everyday writing laws that may screen out justice, but that's our job, isn't it?
Respect.
And basically, what you're saying is that you're giving the district court the final word to misconstrue, miscategorize a motion, and when it comes here, gives us a second prong that we cannot remedy it.
And respectfully, Your Honor, there would be no injustice if the second prong is asking whether or not there was a denial of a constitutional right, whether or not there's a debatable issue of that. And so if the answer to that is no, then this motion never would have prevailed
on
the merits.
But that's a gauntlet that a 60B motion should never have been required to run. That's the point. I agree with you. That is the gauntlet you have to run up here on the COA. But that should never have been the race put before them. It's a burden that it was never designed for them.
And just to conclude in response to Your Honor's question there, the Rule 60B motion in a habeas case is the final order in a habeas proceeding, as this court held in Reed. And in order for that precedent to be overturned, McRae has to point to something more than Gonzalez and Harbison and say that that implicitly overturns that longstanding rule that not only this court, but every other court of appeals that has looked at the issue has adopted. And so unless there are any other questions.
What was the language in Gonzalez that said essentially that the Anti-Terrorism Act did not expressly circumscribe the operation of Rule 60B?
Well, in Gonzalez, there was a certificate of appealability issued. And then in describing 60B, the court noted that every court of appeals, with one exception at that time that had looked at the issue, had held that a certificate of appealability was a requirement for the denial of a 60B in a habeas context.
But I'm noted, we're dealing with the procedural aspect of it, but as Judge Gregory has gotten to some extent, you know, there's procedure and there's a way in which you do things, and sometimes things happen and we use rules to avoid getting to doing the right thing. You have a case in which there's a clear error here. The court has said it's not circumscribed by the Anti-Terrorism Act, and yet the procedural block of a certificate of appealability can be used from the government's perspective to say, well, you still have to go through this hoop here and you got to do this, when nonetheless the error is there, and it's a very simple thing to simply address the error. And I'm not sure Justice Scalia, in writing Gonzalez, went so far as to limit it in the manner that you describe. I mean, you have to look at Harbison, and you have to look at Reed and other cases to get there, but I'm not so sure that was what the Supreme Court meant in that case. It seems rather simple to say, well, successive, if it's not successive in the sense, and you've agreed it's not a successive type, it hasn't been dealt with before, what's the big deal to simply just deal with something that hasn't been dealt with that is before you, in which there's a concession of an error?
And again, I'm over time, Judge Motz, but if I may just briefly respond.
Of course.
Gonzalez says nothing about this issue of whether or not a certificate of appealability should issue. And this second hoop, it's important to understand what the substance of that hoop is. The second hoop is whether or not the petitioner...
The requirement for a certificate of appealability arises from where?
From Section 2253 of AEDPA. And it says...
When it says, AEDPA does not expressly circumscribe the operation of a Rule 60B, that has no import, and yet that's where this requirement arrives, it would seem to me that there would accept, to the extent that a certificate of appealability is required, it doesn't subscribe it.
Gonzalez didn't have to do with the certificate of appealability. Gonzalez was correcting the 11th...
I'm just dealing with that statement that it makes there. And the only question I'm asking, if it's not circumscribed by that act, we now come in and fold in this layer in which it is, because you've got to have the certificate of appealability still.
In order for Gonzalez to reverse the longstanding precedent of this court and every other court holding that a 60B is required, that a certificate of appealability is required to appeal the denial of a 60B in a habeas proceeding, the government's position, respectively, is that it would require more than that. Because in Gonzalez, the court noted that every court of appeals has adopted this rule, and it declined to address whether or not that was right, but it did say that it's a plausible interpretation of the statute and a relatively effective screening mechanism. And so to take Gonzalez and say
to
by
the extent that the Rule 60B would be dealing with substantive issues, of course, that makes sense. I mean, if your Rule 60B is simply going to reiterate that's what's there, then yes, that makes complete sense. But in the instance of, if you can differentiate, Rule 60Bs aren't all the same. And if you have one that's only attacking what the judge did at the habeas, that's a different procedure. I mean, you can argue that forcefully all day long, but I'm not so sure all Rule 60Bs are the same. You don't concede that.
And if I haven't been saying it, when I say a 60B...
Are all Rule 60Bs the same?
Absolutely not.
And some are substantive, some deal with procedural.
If I haven't been saying it, the rule that this court and others have adopted is that the appeal of the denial of a 60B in a habeas proceeding is subject to the certificate of appealability requirement. 60B applies broadly to all civil cases. And so We're here in a habeas case, and so if I've just shorthanded it by saying 60B, what I intend to say is that...
No, that wasn't going to challenge what you were saying. I'm just saying that in terms of looking what the Supreme Court did in Gonzales, there is a difference in Rule 60B motions. They are motions that deal just with the substantive aspect, which fits very neatly into your argument. But those that deal with issues of this type, where you're dealing with what happened at the habeas, seems to be different. Justice Scalia seems to give that flavor, at least in Gonzales, pretty clearly.
The government maintains that Gonzales doesn't speak to this issue of whether or not a certificate of appealability is required.
Well, I've gotten that point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Littlehale?
Briefly, Your Honor. Now, to begin with, the government argued at length that the COA requirement is a necessary screening requirement in the 60B context. But 60B motions already face their own screening requirements. First, they're the time limits imposed in the statute. Second, as Justice Scalia explained in the Gonzales case, 60B motions are subject only to limited deferential review by the Court of Appeals.
He says Gonzales doesn't deal at all with certificate of appealability. It says that all the circuit says is required for 60B, so Gonzales left that alone.
Your Honor, even if that were true, we think that Harbison went ahead and ruled just on this issue. We think that the courts, you know, walking up to the edge in Gonzales is simply irrelevant. I think you need to look at Harbison and Gonzales in conjunction.
What if you have neither Harbison nor Gonzales? Is there any way that you can win?
I think so, Your Honor. I think what this court has decided in the Reed and Weinstock cases is that there's a claims processing rule that is applicable to, as you said earlier, Judge Motz, the dismissal rather than the denial of a 60B motion. And I think it works in this way. It's a claims processing rule. What the Court of Appeals is saying is we're not going to figure out this fact-intensive inquiry of whether it's a 60B or an improper successive. District Court, you know the record. You know this litigant. You presided over the trial. Clean that up before we will even entertain a COA. So I think at the worst case scenario, Your Honor, we would argue that in the cases of a dismissal rather than a denial, that this court should issue a limited remand saying, District Court, please clean this up so we can properly consider whether or not we need to apply a COA test. So that I think that's our ultimate fallback argument in case the COA test survives to this day. I think ultimately, Your Honors, the government seeks this morning to enact a hurdle that no 60B movement can meet. Step one in the hoops, hoop one, I think the government said, was the true 60B motions do not advance constitutional claims. And everyone agrees that that's what the Supreme Court says in Gonzales. Now, at hoop two is to get a COA, we have to prove that we were denied a constitutional right. Now, those two statements are simply incompatible. It's impossible to establish that we meet the COA requirement if we can't even bring a constitutional right under a 60B claim. I think at the end of the day, the right of habeas...
Excuse me, but if you made a 60B motion that challenged the habeas proceeding because you found the judge was taking bribes from the government, something totally separate and apart from the underlying merits, that would be a violation of a constitutional right in the 60B proceeding, right?
I think you would also pretty readily get a COA for that issue, Your Honor.
Right. But I thought your argument was you could never get a COA.
Well, I think as Judge...
I do think that was your argument.
Yeah, I think as Judge Wynn pointed out, Your Honor, that 60B raises a number of issues. The categories 1 through 6, mistake, fraud, new evidence, I believe, is one of them. And also, that context... you would need a COA as well, because that ultimately speaks to the underlying merits. So we're not saying that all 60B motions don't need a COA. We're saying that true 60B motions do not need a COA.
It would be a true 60B motion because the trial was perfect. The trial was perfect, mm-hmm. Absolutely perfect. And all of the appeals along the way have been perfect. But then you got to the habeas court, and for some reason you got not as good counsel as you are and not as ethical as you all are, and they decided to bribe the district judge successive.
Yes. I would argue, if I were the government, I think in that case, I would argue that that's new evidence and that bears to the ultimate merits of the proceeding.
I'm not, it's a big question whether or not you have a constitutional right to a honest judge. It would be a question.
I think that's...
But it would at least be a question.
It would... It's,
you know, I mean, yes, it would get you the COA.
We submit that it's a much closer question that's presented in this case. We think that Harbison and Gonzalez, in this case, provide a clear answer to the question of whether or not a 60B movement needs a COA. And we think the answer is no. I think ultimately the right of habeas holds a special place in American society, and 60B is the only mechanism by which a petitioner can ensure that his first habeas proceeding was fair. And the only question then I think this court has to answer is whether or not Mr. McRae has the ability to actually challenge whether or not his first habeas petition was fair. So unless there are any other questions, Your Honor, we ask the court vacate and remand this case for further proceedings.
I think we're fine. Mr. Littlehale, are you court appointed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You did a fabulous job for your client. We very much appreciate your efforts.
Thank
and
you.
I have to say the government also did it. It's the best set of briefs I've seen in a long time. So
thank you.
Congratulations.
Appreciate that.
We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go to the next case.